The following lecture was delivered at the 18th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Miami, Florida, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Rabbi David Vigler will now present his lecture, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People.
I'd like to take you back 2,000 years to one of the most famous pieces of Talmud. It's at the very end of Tractate Makos in the Talmud, where the Talmud tells us a story of four sages, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Yeshua, and Rabbi Akiva, who were walking towards Jerusalem, and as they came to the ruins of the Holy Temple, they see a fox emerging from the ruins of the Holy of Holies. The three sages, other than Rabbi Akiva, rend their garments and they burst out in tears. Rabbi Akiva, in sharp contrast, begins to laugh. Why are you laughing? The three sages asked Rabbi Akiva. In classic Jewish style, he responds to the question with a question, well, why are you crying? Why are we crying? We're crying because this is the house of God, the Holy of Holies. There's foxes walking through the ruins. That's why we're crying. Look at how we've been destroyed, at how we've been decimated by the Romans. This is precisely why I laugh, answers Rabbi Akiva to his three esteemed colleagues. He tells them that there are two prophecies that speak about, one speaks of destruction and desolation, the other speaks about consolation and comfort. The first, a prophecy by Uriah, Tzion Sade Techerash, that Zion will be plowed over like a field. Plowed over like a field. The second prophecy by Zechariah, Oid Yesh Vuzkenim Vuzkenos Berchoves Yerushalayim, the day will come one day when old men and old women, young boys and young girls will play in the streets of Jerusalem freely without a worry. One is a prophecy of doom, the other a prophecy of renaissance. I wasn't sure if the latter prophecy would come true, but now that I see that the first prophecy has been so fulfilled, now I am certain. When I see the degree and the depth of the destruction, now I know I am assured that the second prophecy too will come to fruition. The sages hear his response and they respond, Akiva nichamtonu, Akiva nichamtonu. Akiva, you have comforted us. Akiva, you have comforted us. But the question we have to ask ourselves is, what, the sages, they didn't believe in redemption? They needed Rabbi Akiva to teach them about a prophecy of redemption? These were sages of Israel, Talmudic giants. Of course they believed in the redemption. Within this piece of Talmud lies the key to our understanding why bad things happen to good people. It was a talk that the Rebbe delivered 50 years ago this week. In 1974, where the Rebbe cracked this code in the most incredibly exciting and deeply personal and relevant way. The Rebbe opened by asking a question. You know, there's more than one prophecy of destruction. Rabbi Akiva had a lot of choices when he was quoting prophecies of doom and gloom. In fact, there's one prophecy of Jeremiah, which is specific to this situation, which would have been a lot more appropriate. We just read it on Tisha B'Av the other day. It's chapter 5 of Lamentations of Jeremiah. Al zeh hayah dovei libeinu. For this, our hearts were desolate. Al har tzion sheshameim. For the Mount of Zion that is desolate. Shualim holchu boy. Foxes are dominating the site. That's exactly what they were observing. Foxes in the Holy of Holies. It would have been so much more appropriate to bring the prophecy of doom, of destruction of Jeremiah, much more than the prophecy of Uriah, stating that Zion will be plowed over like a field. But the Rebbe explained in the most exciting and meaningful way that Rabbi Akiva is opening our eyes with a selection of his prophecy of destruction. You see, what happens when a field is plowed over? I'm a city boy. When I see a field being plowed, I figure it's being destroyed. But a farmer? Oh no. To a farmer, plowing is not an act of destruction. Plowing is the first step in the process of planting. In fact, the deeper the plow, the more effective the subsequent yield. What Rabbi Akiva was telling his colleagues is that what seems to be so evil is really the seeds of redemption. What looks like destruction needs to be reinterpreted from a higher vantage point. From a superficial perspective, plowing looks like you're destroying the field. But the wise person understands that plowing is only the first step in planting. Indeed, in the Jerusalem Talmud, beginning of Tractate Brachos, chapter 3, I believe, paragraph 5, the Talmud tells us a very peculiar story of a cow that was plowing a field in the days 2,000 years ago when suddenly the cow mooed. An Arab stopped the Jewish owner of the cow and he said to him that your cow has just declared that your temple has been destroyed. Moments later, the cow lowed once again. The Arab once again interpreted the mooing of the cow to tell the Jew that your Messiah, your Redeemer, was just born. A very strange piece of Talmud about a talking cow prophesizing events. But what the Talmud is telling us is that the act of destruction of our temple was not to be interpreted only as an act of evil as much as it was the beginning of the process of redemption. The Messiah's birth was part and parcel with the destruction of our temple. That metaphor of the plow holds the key for our ability to crack this code, to understand that the bad things that happen to us need to be interpreted on a deeper level. The bad things that happen to us are actually hidden good. Within the tragedy, Rabbi Akiva sees the subsequent triumph. And it's then that his colleagues respond to him twice. Akiva, you have comforted us. Akiva, you have comforted us. What the Talmud here is telling us, as the Rebbe explains, is that bad things are really hidden good. It's a difficult pill to swallow. But the examples abound all around us. One of our members told me yesterday that her boyfriend is going in for an emergency surgery on his heart early next week. How did this happen, I asked. She said, Rabbi, you won't believe it. A few weeks ago, he was playing on the beach ball with his grandchildren, with my grandchildren. And somehow or other, something happened to his hand that disabled his hand. A perfect summer's day was ruined. But if not for that event that forced him to begin seeing all sorts of doctors, that forced him away from golf. Can you imagine in Florida, in Palm Beach, not being able to play golf and racquetball anymore, pickleball? He had nothing to do with his time. He had no choice but to go see the doctor. And upon examination, the doctor said to him, your life is in peril. You have a severe heart blockage. You're going into surgery on Monday. What seemed like such a terrible event actually turned out to be the event that didn't destroy his summer, it saved his life. There's a famous story out of Israel of a terrorist who stabbed a mashgiach, a kosher supervisor in one of the towns in Israel. When the fellow woke up from the surgery, They told him, we've got good news and we've got better news for you. The good news is that we operated upon you. You'll survive the stabbing. But the better news is that while we were doing surgery on you, we found a tumor growing inside of you. And we made the decision, together with your family, to remove the tumor. How ironic that it was the terrorist stabbing that saved his life. When I was a young yeshiva student, in one of the yeshivas that I studied in, it was a very small program that I was in, I noticed that some of my colleagues were getting on my nerves. It happens sometimes, you know? This one's a narcissist, this one is aloof, this one's checked out. Everyone's had their own little thing. And I'm thinking to myself, God Almighty, why? Why would you put me into this asylum? But I decided nothing can happen for the bad. There's got to be something good in here. I was soon preparing to get married. So I figured, you know what? Instead of me going through a dating process, I'm going to identify the personality traits that drive me bananas so that by the time I'm out of here, I'll know exactly what I'm looking for. Let me tell you, by the time I came home to Johannesburg, South Africa, my parents asked me who I wanted to marry. I gave them a list. I can't handle A, B, C, D, and F. These ones, I'm okay with. I had identified that the one character that I was seeking in my wife didn't need to be married to a rocket scientist. I needed kindness. Kindness of heart was the one character trait that I needed. I had successfully managed to turn a negative into a positive. And I'm proud to say that the first woman I dated was the mother of my 11 children. The Torah tells us, when you analyze the Torah, you'll notice this truth coming out everywhere. How bad things are really hidden good. Before the Jewish people crossed the Red Sea, the Torah tells us, Vayihi he'onon ve'achoshech v'yo'er es halayla. There was cloud and there was darkness and it illuminated the night. The cloud and the darkness illuminated the night? What does that even mean? How does night illuminate darkness? This was a question asked by the fifth Rebbe, the Rebbe Rashab of Chabad, in 1915. In his Magnus Opus, one of the most profound works of all of Chabad philosophy, it's called Ayin Beis, a reference to the Hebrew year in which it was begun. He asked this question, what is it supposed to mean that the darkness illuminated the night? The Rebbe Rashab explained, it was right around Passover time, when he explained in this discourse that the darkness is not the absence of light, it's the abundance of it. Darkness is not the absence of light, it's the abundance of light. It's something so intense that you can't see anything. Like imagine somebody shines 1,000,000 volts in your eyes, God forbid. It will blind the person because it's the intensity of light, it's not the lack thereof. 5 or 6 months later, a young Viennese scientist by the name of Albert Einstein issued a paper that he called The Theory of Relativity to the Prussian Academy of Science. And in it, he posited that the universe contains massive balls of light that appear as dark. He called them black holes. Now, since 1915, this was a theory. Until April 2019, 104 years later, a team of global scientists managed to take the first ever photograph of a black hole. You can see it on the internet. It's a perimeter, black, and the light is only on the outside. Because the black hole is such an intense vacuum of energy, it moves faster than the speed of light, which means the vacuum, the power in the black hole, moves faster than 186,000 meters per second, faster than the speed of light. Therefore, the light itself is sucked into the hole. It's not the absence of light. It is the intensity of it. This is a truth that is emerging just now in the past 5 years, where we realize that what seems dark is actually the intensity of light. What seems bad is actually the intensity of good. In fact, how do you cure a snake bite? Anti-venom is made from the venom of the snake itself. Indeed, in Hebrew, the holy language, the word for crisis is mashber, M-A-S-H-B-E-R, mashber. Mashber has another meaning as well. In the beginning of the book of Exodus, when Pharaoh ordered the Jewish midwives to execute the Jewish boys upon birth, the name mashber comes up. Mashber is a birthing stool. The word for crisis in Hebrew is also the word for a birthing stool. Now, I've never done it myself, but giving birth seems pretty painful. But the bad experience, the painful experience, pales in the face of the lifetime of pleasure that follows with the welcoming of new life into this world. A superficial perception of that experience will say, this is evil, this is painful, this is suffering. But a broad-minded perception will see the greater horizon and understand that what is going on in the birthing stool is not a punishment for the mother as much as it is the introduction of the greatest joy that this world is able to give us. Indeed, throughout the Torah, we see examples where things that should be bad are actually good. When Moses encounters the bitter waters after the crossing of the Red Sea, how does he sweeten the waters? He throws in a bitter stick. You'd think a bitter stick is bad, but no, it's the bitter stick that sweetens to teach us that things are not as they seem. Elisha, the prophet, in the very first miracle that he performs after his succession of Elijah the prophet in the book of Kings, he encounters the residents of Jericho who complain about the waters again being bitter. And how does he sweeten the water? Not with sugar, but with salt. To teach us that though it seems bitter, it actually is a sweetener. I know many people in my community that have moved past their personal troubles. They don't want to talk about the divorce. They don't want to talk about the bankruptcy. They don't want to talk about the dark times in their lives. They moved on, Rabbi, we don't go there. Just yesterday, Friday, I made the mistake of asking one of our members in the hospital about his relationship with his siblings. Didn't go well. But as Jews, we have a very fascinating custom. On a Friday night, as we walk away from the rat race, from the 6 days of the week, and we enter the cocoon, the sanctuary of Shabbos, we want to just divest of all the headaches of the week behind us. We want to move into Shabbos, into our spiritual sanctuary. But what do we do during Lecha Dodi, come my beloved, to greet the bride? At the end of Lecha Dodi, we about face. We turn around to face the week from whence we come. We face our troubles, recognizing, admitting, and acknowledging that who we are today is a product of where we come from. Instead of moving past our troubles, we embrace them, understanding that the bad things that happen to us actually are what made us who we are today and what brought us to where we stand right now. From a slightly different angle, this idea, a little difficult to process, bear with me here. We asked a big question, why bad things happen to good people? And we're working our way towards cracking that code. We have one metaphor from the plow. The deeper the plow, the greater the subsequent growth. You want to break that field into tiny little pieces. But the Rebbe gave us another perspective to meditate upon. And that is when it comes to the destruction of our temple in Tisha B'Av, which we commemorated just several days ago. The Rebbe asked a question. On the Shabbos, before my bris, 1980, 2 weeks ago, Shabbos Parshas Devarim, the Shabbos before Tisha B'Av, the Rebbe asked a question. How can it be that God allowed the destruction of our temple? How could it be? We know that everything that God tells us to do, He does Himself. That's a founding principle in Jewish spirituality. So if God tells us in the code of Jewish law that you're not allowed to destroy a temple, you're not allowed to destroy a shul. You know, in Gaza, when the disengagement happened in 2005, even the Israeli government, the secular government, did not destroy the shuls. You may have noticed a video emerging from Gaza a few days ago of IDF soldiers entering into a shul that is still there since the disengagement. The chairs are a little dusty, but it was quite a moving moment. I believe these soldiers were from Gaza before. You're not allowed to destroy a shul. How then can God allow the destruction of our temple? Now, lest you say that it wasn't God who did it, God tells us explicitly in the Torah, in Jeremiah chapter 7, chapter 25, chapter 32, he tells us, just an example, I will dispatch my servant from the north, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. I shall deliver the city in the hands of the king of Babylonia. I shall deliver. So how is it, the Rebbe asked, that God is allowed to violate his own commandments of destroying the temple? The Rebbe answered that there is only one time that you're allowed to destroy a shul. And that is when you're destroying the shul in order to rebuild it in the same place. The act of destruction of our temple was allowed only because it was part and parcel of the process of construction. You know how you feel when you demolish your old kitchen cabinets? You remember that feeling? Isn't that the most amazing feeling? Can't get that stuff out of here fast enough. When you redo that bathroom, can't wait for the day of demo. Just get it all out of here. Is that an act of destruction? Of course not. That is the renovation. You got to do the demo before you can bring in all the gorgeous new stuff. Those beautiful onyx and quartzite countertops, they can't come in with all the schmutz that you have there from before. Get it out of here. The destruction of the old is actually a part and parcel of the process of renovation. The Rebbe drew on the Zohar, the book of Kabbalah, which explains that the first two temples were built by mortals, by mortal human beings. And therefore, anything built by mortals has a time limit, has an expiration date, like mortals themselves. The first two temples needed to be destroyed in order to allow the third temple to be built, Mikdash Adnai Koinenu Yodecha, that God Almighty is going to build the third temple so that the immortal, infinite, almighty God will build a house that will last forever. The destruction of the old was necessary to allow the introduction of the new. Now, admittedly, it's taking a little time. Being 2,000 years, it sounds like a Florida contractor. When are you going to finish the kitchen? 2,000 years later, he's still working on it. In our personal lives as well, when marriage falls apart, you know, after you get out of the honeymoon phase, our Bubby calls it the 7-year blues. When anger, mistrust, resentment, and boredom begin to creep into the marriage, when you're over the state of enchantment, when you're over being enamored, and now real life kicks in. Is it time to move on? Get another one? I guess if you live in Hollywood, that's how it works. But Chassidus explains to us that it's the falling apart of the old that is making way for the new. You see, a new connection needs to be built in your relationship. Your first attraction was based upon mortal romance and physical attraction. It's now time to replace that with the eternal values of divine union. Instead of looking at that need for marriage therapy as a negative experience, as the beginning of the end, look at it as the end of the beginning. A new beginning is dawning, a new day is rising, a connection that overrides physical attraction, that overrides financial capacity, a connection that is soulful, a connection that is deep, a connection that is forever. When your job might be falling apart and you happen to notice that your boss passed you over for promotion yet again, and you realize that you might not be going anywhere in your job, or maybe you see the writing on the wall that you're on the way out. Instead of looking at that as a negative experience, perhaps, when God is not taking you your way, it's because he's found a better route. One of my members called me up frantically several years ago. He and I had recently had the courage to put mezuzahs up in his top-notch firm on his door. A few weeks later, he was terminated in one day. He wasn't allowed to collect his files. Everything was terminated. Any email access, passwords, in one shot, one fell swoop, he was terminated. This grown man came crying to me, "Rabbi, what am I going to do?" We worked through it together with empathy, with reflection, with meditation. It took him several weeks. But this man, whose entire life had worked as an employee, a brilliant man, had worked as an employee, was now forced to open his own company. And boy, was he successful. For the first time in his life, he was able to come to shul on Shabbos because now he was making his own hours. He told me, "Rabbi, I'm making more money than I've ever made before." What seemed to have been a catastrophe turned out to be the catalyst that he needed to rise to his divine destiny, to the purpose for which he was dispatched to this world. A man who had the ability, the courage, the foresight, the humility to be able to recognize the hidden hand of God in that which seemed like his field was being destroyed, in what seemed like his kitchen was being wrecked apart, he recognized the beginning of the new. I chuckle as I think of the 3M scientist, Spencer Silver, who had the unfortunate, well, misfortune, of inventing a glue that didn't stick. What are you going to do with the glue that didn't stick? His superiors told him, "This is the dumbest thing we've ever heard. Get rid of it. Cancel the project." But 3M had a policy then that allowed them to allowed employees, in order to promote creative thinking, allowed the employees to override their superiors and to go to the superior of their superior. But each superior told them the same thing. "This is ridiculous. This is absurd." He kept on rising in the ranks until somebody allowed him to pursue the project. And Spencer Silver invented the billion-dollar product called the Post-it note. It all began when he was singing in a church choir and his bookmarks kept out of falling out of the book. And he was all frustrated. He didn't want to write in the book, but he needed them to stick, but not too much. Here was a man who turned a negative into a beautiful positive. And here, my friends, we're introduced to the great paradox of our lives. The paradox which represents the conflict between what we see and what we sense. Sometimes we need to desperately seek to find the light with our heart when all our eyes can see is darkness. We have to be able to meditate on both of those metaphors, the plowing metaphor as well as the renovation metaphor, to be able to reinterpret that which happens to us. You know, in the 1950s, the Rebbe took a day off. Now, the Rebbe never took a day off. My wife's grandfather, Rabbi Yehuda Krinsky, is the Rebbe's chief of staff, and was the Rebbe's personal driver and secretary for very many years. It was actually on the day of his engagement, of Rabbi Krinsky's engagement to my wife's grandmother, that he drove the Rebbe for this day off to the Chabad overnight camp, Camp Gan Israel, which then was in Swan Lake, upstate New York. The story goes that Abubi of blessed memory, would tell us that the car actually broke down on the way back. And you know, in those days, no cell phones. Rabbi Krinsky missed his own engagement party. Wasn't pretty, but you know, she was a righteous woman. At that, can you imagine what the campers and counselors felt like, that the Rebbe is coming to camp? My son called me up from camp the other day. He said, "Tati, you know, camp is amazing." My 9-year-old. He said, "Camp is amazing, but you know, I'm a little nervous because they said something about something happening today called a bedside inspection. I don't know what it is, but it's making me a little nervous." I said, "Don't worry, you'll be fine." So the Rebbe is coming to visit the commander-in-chief. The counselors and the campers began to clean that camp like it had never been cleaned before. And you know when you have guests at short notice, you know that one room? You know what I'm talking about? The one room where everything goes? It's that closet that you just sort of like lock it and hope and pray that nobody's going to walk in there. If you just open that door, it's going to just cascade out of there, right? They had that one room. And the Rebbe made it his business to inspect every part of the camp. Lo and behold, the Rebbe came looking for that room, and he came. "I want to go in this door," the Rebbe said. Oops. As they opened the door, the Rebbe chuckled as he realized exactly what this room was used for. But then he noticed a little sign on the wall. One of the counselors, in humor, wrote a little sign on the wall, and he said, "Zecher lachurban," which translates as a testament, as a memory to the destruction of our temple. It's actually a law in the Torah. You're supposed to have in your house a little piece of your house which is unfinished paint or plaster, just to remind us of the destruction of our temple. Like we break the glass under the chuppah, there's a certain Jews put some ash on the head of the groom on the day of the chuppah, just, you know, to remind us of the temple destruction. The Rebbe looks at the sign, "Zecher lachurban." This room is a mess to remind us of the destruction of the temple. And in his inimitable style, a story that my wife says creates her worldview. The Rebbe quipped, he said, "Why did they call it Zecher Lachurban? Why did they call it a memory to the destruction when they, for the same price, they could have called it Zecher Lamikdash, a testament, a memory of the Holy Temple? Why do you have to focus on the negative when for the same price you can focus on the positive? Why do you have to choose a superficial perception of reality when at the same time you can choose an elevated, broad-minded perception of the greater truth at play?" This is not easy, my friends. It's not an easy way to live our lives. We need to have the courage to raise our horizons and to see the bigger picture. Indeed, in the words of Shema Yisrael, which we read just yesterday in the Torah, the most famous testament, affirmation of our faith, we say Shema Yisrael. Our sages tell us that the word Shema is an acronym for three words that we read yesterday in the Haftarah of Nachamu at the end of chapter 40 of Isaiah's comforting prophecy. The last words of this Haftarah, of his prophecy, read, "Su'u marom einechem," raise the horizons of your eyes. That is the meaning of Shema Yisrael. Have the courage to lift your eyes up and to see the bigger picture. Break free from tunnel vision. You don't need to be stuck in the smaller perception of reality. This, my friends, the Tanya tells us, is the test for which we were created. Tanya, in the final part of Tanya, the fifth section of Tanya, Epistle 11, my favorite part of Tanya, the Alter Rebbe tells us that it was to achieve this clarity that we were placed upon this earth. What a bold statement. To be able to rise above our knee-jerk reaction of fear, and to have the courage, the wisdom, and the humility to react not with fear, but with faith. To see the hidden good within the bad, that is the test for which we were placed upon this earth. Indeed, the word test in Hebrew is a nisayon. Nisayon also means an elevation. Nes means to elevate. Because when we are being tested, within the question lies the answer. Within the bad lies the good. The word test in Hebrew means elevate. We're called upon, we're challenged to elevate our perceptions and to see the bigger picture. You know, it's the opening word of the Torah, which declares the mission statement of mankind. What's the first word in the Torah? Bereshis, in the beginning. That word, Bereshis, is two words, our sages tell us. Bara Shis, created a covering, created a concealment. The word Shis is a very interesting Hebrew word. For those that are familiar with the Hebrew, when after the sin of the tree of knowledge, of the plant of higher consciousness, Adam and Eve were punished. Eve was punished. God tells her, "Ve'eva ashis beincha uveina isha." It's a snake who was told, "And I will superimpose hatred, enmity, contempt between you, the snake, and the woman. Naturally, you were friends, but I'm going to impose an unnatural hatred between you." This word comes up all over the Torah. Yosef, Yashis Yada Elinecha, and Joseph will cover your eyes, conceal your eyes at the end of Genesis. This word Shis means a covering, a concealment, a veil. Barash Shis, the first word of the Torah, means God created a veil. God created a smokescreen. That is the mission statement of mankind. Our mission is to break open the curtain, to peer beyond the veil, and to sense the goodness with our hearts, when our eyes can only see evil. Indeed, the name of this world is Olam in Hebrew. A world is Olam. The word Olam means He'elem, concealment. It's a place where God is hiding from us. This world is a game of hide and seek. Our mission is to be able to say, God, I know you're hiding in this problem. I know you're hiding in this challenge. You're not going to fool me. Now, admittedly, this is far from easy. It takes a giant like Rabbi Akiva to be able to come to this perception to transform the reality that lies before us. Rabbi Akiva, the Rebbe, explained in that same talk 50 years ago this week, on the occasion of his father's Yahrzeit. The Rebbe's father passed away whilst in exile, suffering at the hands of the communists. In Almaty, in Kazakhstan, it's the middle of absolutely nowhere, this Torah giant was left without paper, without ink, to be able to write down the wisdom that was gushing within him. And here the Rebbe explained how we are able to reinterpret the evil that happens to us. The Rebbe explained that the four sages who were walking down who were walking towards the Temple Mount at the beginning of this lecture, at the end of Tractate Makos, were very, very interesting people. Rabban Gamliel was the head of the academy. He was a descendant of Judah, a scion of King David. Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah was a Kohen, descended from Aaron, the high priest. And Rabbi Yehoshua, the third sage, was a Levite who personally sang in the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. The fourth sage, Rabbi Akiva, he was an absolute nobody. He had no pedigree. You know who he came from? It's shocking. The Talmud tells us that Rabbi Akiva was descended from none other than Haman, the arch anti-Semite, the Iranian who threatened to wipe out our nation entirely, God forbid, and the Holocaust that never happened in the Purim story just 2,200 years ago. Another opinion says he comes from Sisera, another arch enemy of the Jewish people. It was actually not the Talmud, it was Rav Nissim Gaon who says that Rabbi Akiva comes from Haman. And the Arizal, the saintly Kabbalist, the Arizal from Tzfas, explains that when the Torah tells us that Esau had hunting skill in his mouth, that's a veiled reference to Rabbi Akiva, who was descended from Esau himself, the first anti-Semite. This is the pedigree of Rabbi Akiva. It's Rabbi Akiva, says the Rebbe 50 years ago, who understands the power of transformation. It's Rabbi Akiva who understands that you can never judge a book by its cover. What looks like Haman, what looks like Esau, has buried within it a gorgeous diamond, a beautiful gem. Don't ever lose sight of the forest because of the trees. And the Rebbe said it goes even more than that. The shocking story of Rabbi Akiva's marriage. You see, Rabbi Akiva was married to a very righteous woman, a beautiful story. But he had a nemesis. The Talmud tells us in Avodah Zarah 20a, Nedarim 50b, the Talmud tells us that the nemesis of Rabbi Akiva was Turnus Rufus, the Roman governor of Judea. He would constantly debate with Rabbi Akiva. One day, Turnus Rufus, the Roman governor, comes home to his own wife in a particularly foul mood. "What happened to you?" his wife asks him. "It's that wretched Rabbi Akiva who once again bested me in the Senate in front of my colleagues. He humiliated me. I can't ever beat him." "If you wish," says the wife of Turnus Rufus, "I can make him go away." The Talmud tells us she was one of the most beautiful women at that time. She was a skilled seductress. "Will you give me permission," she asks her husband, "to seduce the rabbi so that we can publicly humiliate him? He'll never show his face in town again. He'll never be able to resist me." "Go right ahead," he said. She corners the rabbi. And the Talmud tells us that Rabbi Akiva responded in the most peculiar response. He spat, he cried, and he laughed. She was perplexed. "Never seen that reaction in a man before," she says. "What on earth was that all about?" He tells her, "I can tell you two of the things that I did, but I can't tell you the third. You see, I spat because I reminded myself that like all human beings, your beauty also originates in a putrid drop, a drop of semen, nothing to get excited about. And I cried because I realized that one day your beauty too will go the way of all human beings down into the earth. And I need to control myself. But I cannot tell you why I left." Okay. She leaves, failing in her mission. And of course, Rabbi Akiva sticks around. But when Turnus Rufus passes away, guess what happens? The wife of Turnus Rufus converts to Judaism. And who does she marry? The widower, Rabbi Akiva, who had recently lost his own wife. And when he marries her, he says, "Now I can reveal to you the reason why I left. Because I sensed that what was being offered to me in sin, in darkness, was one day going to be given to me in purity and in light." Now I ask you, if Mrs. Hania, the widow of Ismael Hania, puts up a profile on JDate, how would you swipe? I mean, who in their right mind would want to marry the wife of the arch anti-Semite of the time? No normal Jew would ever want to marry Mrs. Arafat, for heaven's sake, or Mrs. Hitler. It takes a Rabbi Akiva, the master of transformation, to be able to never judge a book by its cover, but to sense the diamond that's buried within the rough. Whilst we might not be there yet, when the Talmud teaches us about Rabbi Akiva and about his profoundly brilliant metaphor of plowing through the Holy Temple, we're at least given the tools of aspiration. Because just like in the game of golf, if you don't know where you're going, you're never going to be able to get there. It's only when we know what we're aspiring towards that we can ever dream of reaching that goal. So what can we do about this? Okay. So we've been given brilliant metaphors to tell us why bad things happen to good people. Bad things happen to good people because they're not bad, they're hidden good. Okay. Tough pill to swallow. But what am I going to do with that piece of information? Fifth part of Tanya, Epistle 11. The Alter Rebbe continues with some of the most stunning words. Ube'emuna zu na'ase be'emes hakol toiv gam begolui. And with this faith, says the Alter Rebbe, the founder of Chabad, with the courage to reinterpret the bad things as hidden good, our thoughts, our perception transforms the reality, even in a revealed sense, where the apparent evil is transformed into revealed good. Wow. This is not just mental gymnastics. This is pure survival. Because as we look at the world around us and we think of rising anti-Semitism, and oh my gosh, here is an anti-Semite, there is an anti-Semite. It feels like a global game of whack-a-mole. They keep on rising out of nowhere. If we choose to react not with fear, but with hearts filled with faith, recognizing that this is not God abandoning us, but God testing us for the greatest test of our lives. It's then that we will transform the depth, the intensity of this darkness into an equally proportionate intensity of light. If this is the greatest suffering that we have experienced in our lives since the Holocaust, it means that the plow is so intensely deep. It means that the light that is being born right now is a light more intense than we have ever encountered in our lives before. The light we're about to encounter is the light of the redemption of Mashiach himself. I'd like to share with you three, maybe four, if we have time, case studies of actual men or groups of people who successfully succeeded in transforming their ominous outcome against all odds by applying this wisdom in the Torah. This wisdom was shared with us by our recent mystics, the Rebbes of Chabad, opening our eyes to the struggles we face today. You see, the Torah tells us that in the desert, soon after coming out of Egypt, the Jewish people complained and they were bitten by snakes. The Torah tells us that God tells Moses to build a copper snake and to have the people stare up at the snake. V'haya kol anashuch v'hibit al nechash anechoshet v'chai, and it shall be all who were bitten, and they shall stare at the copper snake and they will live. The Talmud asks, is the snake capable of determining life or death? Nachmanides, 900 years ago, Ramban tells us that far from exposure therapy of sorts, what they were looking at was that they had the courage to stare their tormentor in the eye, the very cause of their affliction, the snake itself. As they looked at the snake, they recognized the bright blue sky behind it, recognizing the snake not as the tormentor, but as a mere emissary of God Almighty, of God in heaven behind it. They recognized that instead of being afraid of the snake was merely an emissary, not capable of hurting them, but one sent to inspire them to look up, a test to lift up. And when they did this, they indeed were healed. In 1927, the previous Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, the Rebbe's father-in-law, was working feverishly to keep Judaism alive in communist Russia, which banned religion at all costs. Against all odds, he successfully built an army of Hasidim called Miarmi Admura, who fought to build what is estimated as 600 Jewish schools throughout Soviet Russia. Some opened for just a few days before its operators were sent to the frozen wastelands of Siberia. In 1927, one night in June, the Friedrich Rebbe himself was arrested and sent, given a death sentence. He was sent to Shpalerka, a prison, where in his journal he writes, "The prisoners were stripped of their humanity and their rights. They were denied access from even knowing the time." He writes, "At 6:30 in the morning to 7, they woke us up. 7:30, bread would be given out, and lights out were at 10:30 p.m. But I knew the time," said the previous Rebbe in his journal, "because I remembered, I felt like Moses on the mountain." Remember Moses on the mountain for 40 days? He also didn't have a clock. But how he knew the time, the Zohar tells us, that when he heard the angels saying Kadosh, he knew it was day. And when he heard the angels saying Baruch, he knew that it was night. And that's how he knew the time. The Rebbe asks a question on Shabbos Chukas Balak, the 12th of Tammuz in 1969. Remember summer of 69? The Rebbe asks the question and he says, "I could think a few scenarios more polar opposite. The previous Rebbe languishing in a communist prison and Moses on the mountain with God Almighty. This is what the previous Rebbe felt like. He felt like Moses on the mountain in communion with God." Here the Rebbe tells us the same exact principle. The previous Rebbe refused to surrender to the apparent evil that surrounded him. He understood that just like Moses on the mountain could not tell the time because that was the will of God, he too was unable to tell the time because that was the will of God. He was not in the hands of the communists. He was in the hands of God. This was not the apparent evil that it seemed. It was the hidden good that he sensed. And it was with this perception that indeed, miraculously, the decree was reversed. The Rebbe tells us that if not that the previous Rebbe would have been released, Chabad would not exist. There would be no JLI retreat. There would be no Chabad, God forbid, because at that time in 1927, there was no successor for the previous Rebbe. Who was the first one to chart this path? It was our forefather Jacob. Jacob, in one of the most enigmatic encounters in the Torah, struggles all night long with a strange angel. Now, let me ask you. If you were in a dark alley one night, and some hoodlum beat you up all night long, and at one point he says, "I'm really sorry, but I gotta go," what would you say? "Good riddance. Goodbye, and don't ever come back." Not Jacob. Not Jacob. Jacob says, "I refuse to let you go. Ki im beirachtani, until you bless me." Jacob understands that what seems to be an assailant is actually a hidden blessing, a hidden angel. Not an assailant, but an angel of God. And indeed, the blessing he gives him is, "No longer shall your name be called Jacob," which means a heel. "From now on, your name will be called Israel. For you have struggled with angels and with men, and you have prevailed." You've refused to succumb to the apparent perceptions of what you were facing. You've had the courage to peer deeper and to remain unmoved and unafraid. You are forevermore known as Israel. That is the name that you and I all carry to this very day. We are the sons of Jacob. We are B'nai Yisrael, because each and every one of us are called upon to do the same, to rise to those amazing heights, the heights of Rabbi Akiva, of the previous Rebbe, of the generation of wisdom in the desert who were bitten by snakes, to rise to the DNA that flows in our veins. We are all the descendants of Jacob. We can do this. There's a very famous story in the Torah. I'm not going to get into the full story right now. I'm out of time. But it's about Nachum Ish Gamzu. Nachum, the man of this also. This man, any evil experience he encountered, he would say the same three words, Gam Zu Letova. This too is for the good. And in one famous encounter, he found himself before the Roman Caesar with what he thought was a chest of jewels. Unbeknownst to him, he had been robbed. And instead of jewels, it was a chest of earth. He was bringing a gift from the Jewish people to curry the favor of the emperor. You can only imagine that when the emperor opened the box, the chest, and found the earth, he was not impressed. Off to the gallows, ordered the emperor. What was the reaction of Nachum? Gam zu letova. This too is for the good. Nachum ish gam zu applied this wisdom. And indeed, Elijah the prophet appears in the form of one of the government ministers. He comes to the emperor and he says, the Jews aren't that stupid as to send you a box of earth. This must be the earth, the miraculous earth of Abraham. He would throw earth at his enemies. It turned into spears and swords. Try it. Roman emperor tried it, and indeed it turned out to be miraculous soil. And indeed, Nachum Ish Gam Zu was saved. His mindset changed his reality. Who was the most famous student of Nachum? Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva learned this wisdom. And friends, if there's nothing else you take away from here today, I want you to try to write down these three words. I want you to take them with you. Commit them to memory. Anytime something happens to you that's bad, let go of those four-letter words. You don't need them anymore. Replace it with three words, Gam Zu Letova. Gam Zu Letova. This too is for the good. I have no idea how just yet, but he knows. And with that faith, you'll transform your reality. Friends, we stand today at the very end of exile, on the precipice of redemption. The words exile and redemption have exactly the same letters, the same spelling. Goyla, exile, and Geula is exactly the same spelling with one difference. Redemption has an aleph. The Rebbe tells us that that word aleph that separates between exile and redemption represents a'alefcha, which means awareness. The only difference between an exile mentality and a Mashiach mindset is our courage to believe, to become conscious, to rise to godly awareness. Remember that the only difference, well, the Rebbe tells us, I believe this was one of the great spiritual revolutions of our Rebbe, that our thoughts have the power to transform our reality. In that same talk of 1969, the Rebbe extends this idea also to money. He says, if you think you don't have enough money for the mitzvahs that you need to do, don't be afraid. Don't accept it as a fait accompli. Well, we can't afford that. If you say you can, or if you say you can't, you're right. Your thoughts change your reality. When you shift your mindset and you say, yes, we can. I'm not afraid of my snake. I'm not afraid of the communists. I'm not afraid of the Roman emperor. I'm not afraid of my assailant. I'm not afraid of my banker or my bank account. When you have the courage to say that, then indeed, the Rebbe tells us, it will flow. Adopt the mindset of Gam Zu Letova. Don't be afraid. Don't fear. It's just a test. Look up. And remember that the only difference between an ugly lump of black coal and a gorgeous diamond that dazzles is the amount of pressure that it endures. Pressure is good for you. It brings out the best in us. And as Isaiah read to us yesterday from 2,700 years ago, Nachamu, Nachamu Ami, comforted, comforted shall be my people. He was talking about us, about the generation that will welcome Mashiach. Just like Rabbi Akiva 2,000 years ago, whose colleagues told them, Nachamu, Nichamtonu, Nichamtonu, you have comforted us. You've given us the tools not only to handle the pain, but even the power to transform it. Isaiah empowers us with the same. The generation that will welcome the Mashiach will too have the courage to be able to face their fears, to stare their snake in the eye, to boldly approach their fears with the awareness, with the consciousness to transform it. I call upon us all to never again be afraid of the dark, because whenever you might feel like you're grappling in the darkness, when you feel like your world is caving in on you and you feel like you're being buried, you're actually being planted. Don't tell your God how big your problems are. Tell your problems how big your God is. Thank you very much.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.